Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Revolution Radio. Happy New Year. This is Dr. Kate, and I am pleased to be joined by Red Beckman this evening. Red, are you there?
I'm here.
Excellent. How are you this evening?
Well, I'm doing pretty well because we had kind of a dry day, and so I was able to accomplish something outside.
Excellent. Very good. Glad to hear that, and Happy New Year to you.
And the same to you.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to all the listeners and all the folks who will be listening on the podcast, which I hope there are many. Hi, Arizona Conservative guest, and welcome to the chat room. tonight, I wanted to start with an introduction here and then sort of set the frame for, I believe, the next several Revolution Radio shows, at least the ones on Wednesday night. On Thursday night, we, of course, are going to be delighted again to be joined by Red and Terry Dodd. Tonight, there's a pretty important conference call with the Continental Congress, and Terry is actually sitting in on that call for me this evening so I can do this show. So glad to be here. remember JFK said that those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. And I'm just pleased to announce, if you already hadn't felt it, that the revolution, the peaceful revolution, is actually here. There's been an enormous consciousness rising and raising in the last year, and I think that's going to accelerate. And I believe we now can actually see what has happened in this country to bring us to the point right now. In other words, there don't seem to be any new tricks that are coming up. We know that part of the terrorism, for example, is in part being encouraged by the looking away, if you will, at that issue within the United States, and of course the political correctness BS, which doesn't allow you to call radical Islamic jihad radical Islamic jihad, so forth. So we also see that you know, the 50-point plan of the communists to take over America is in full swing. They've got probably 30 or 40 of those items on their checklist in good swing. We also have this peculiar situation of a Congress, and Republicans especially, who should be screaming up and down about the constitutional violations, but they're not. So you begin to wonder how far thick is this? Are they all engaged? Do they all have each other on some issue? Who's being blackmailed? And if you take a look at my Dr. Kate's view, I put up an article a day or so ago on what I consider to be now evidence of, or at least the appearance of, blackmail of Barack Obama. He has so much to hide. Therefore, he has so much to give away. Most recently, on December 16th, he signed an executive order that gave Interpol full access to, or basically immunity from, prosecution for anything that they do in the United States. So that means they can come and seize and search and arrest you, take you away, and they're not subject to any American laws. He reverses a key piece of the Reagan executive order, which required that Interpol be essentially under our own authority, not their authority. So this is obviously along the plan of destroying the Constitution. That's Article 1, Section 9, just in case you're interested. But also, what did he give up? Did he get immunity from Interpol for things that they probably know that we don't know, in exchange for getting access to Americans? So all over the place, this is a very detailed discussion, and I'm just hitting, quote-unquote, the highlights. Please visit Dr. Kate's view if you want to take a look at those details. But this is really, we're facing, essentially, we had a coup and we're facing it, and the awareness that we've generated in the last year, the Articles of Freedom, all of these things launch us right now into the second American Revolution, in my view. And thank goodness the Articles of Freedom just happened to be there, because they propose a pathway back to what I'm going to call constitutional governance. And that's what I'd like to talk about tonight, and ask for Red's assistance on particular issues regarding how we move as jurors, as citizens, and so forth. But the constitutional governance, what does that mean? I remind everybody that the only visions we have out there of the future are death and destruction, communist rule, you know, over in your living room every day, et cetera, et cetera. We don't have any visions of constitutional governance aside from, quote, what it used to be. Now, we are drawing from the document and how it used to be to create a vision of how it's supposed to be. And that is the revolutions that have failed, frankly, of the ones that, in my view, have failed to produce decent vision. And I think the Articles of Freedom are a start on that vision, but I think how we implement it this year, the essence of constitutional governance is the people. It's us. And we have allowed this government to get to be where it is. We're the ones who created the government. We allowed this. We have been asleep. Not everyone, and, you know, God bless us all. There's been a lot of stuff going on, but we certainly have been distracted. And now I feel, at least in my life, I finally figured out what I'm supposed to be when I grow up, and that is someone who gets back to constitutional governance, what it means with people act with people's actions. So this evening, and for the foreseeable future, I'd like to sort of take the Articles of Freedom piece by piece, depending on whatever subject we would like to talk about, and generally discuss what the issue is, what the problem is, and to generally present what remedial actions we have presented to Congress. And it's important to understand that word remedial. We are giving them instructions on how to get back to constitutional governance. They probably don't know how to do that, so who's going to create that vision? We are. And as you see through the Articles of Freedom, a lot of the action, if you will, is not only on the state level, but it is with us. So that's what we're going to do this evening. And I've read, how does that sound like sound for an agenda in the next several shows?
This is really appropriate. I just hope we had, I would hope that we would get a bigger audience, because we have groups meeting all over these United States of America. If you've got a small town out in South Dakota or North Dakota, pretty remote, more than likely you will have a small group of people that are meeting probably on a weekly basis. And they're discussing exactly what we're talking about here. What happened to our country? Where are we going? How do we get back? And I think that one of the things that makes it more difficult for people to you know, become involved effectively. People talk about the Constitution, and when you talk about the Constitution, it people say, "Oh, I don't want to get into that. That's, you know, lawyers and judges are the ones that are supposed to explain the Constitution and all." And they just think it's, well, it's mental conditioning. Through the, you know, the propaganda media and the propaganda school system and the propaganda churches and such, and so people have a tendency to kind of shy away from the Constitution and understanding it. And I think the reason is that we have talked about the, you know, the different sections of the Constitution and what they mean. Article 1, Section 8, of course, is so so vital and all. But the number one thing to understand the Constitution is understand the intent. And this is what we have failed to really concentrate on in the freedom movement. Is reminding people of what the intent of the Constitution is. And once they really have a grasp of what the intent is, what was the intent of the founders when they created that document? And once you understand that, then when you start reading the Constitution, everything just falls into place. It just... you have to start out in the right spot, and that is the intent. and the intent was to create a government that the people could control, and that it was limited government. They didn't want too much government because they realized that too much government gets too expensive, and too much government has such a tendency to, you might say, become oppressive and too expensive and inefficient and all those kind of things. And so if you understand that the Constitution is a law which we the people wrote, and we wrote it to create a government and to define the powers that we were willing to let that government exercise. And so starting out with just the basic principles like that, the Constitution, when you start reading it, it just all comes together for us. And, you know, I just have not heard that many people talking about the intent. You know, they say in the law business that intent is 90% of the law. And it's just you have to know what the intentions were. And once you have that, you don't get that from the Constitution itself. You have to understand a little, or know a little bit about the history of the time when the Constitution was created. But, Dr. Kate, we can just be thrilled to death with what is happening in this country. All these groups all over this country. I'm going to be a very, very busy man here in the near future. Once we get past the holidays here and all, I've got invitations to speak in all kinds of nooks and crannies in this country. And, of course, I'm not traveling very far, but I don't have to because these little groups are every place. Just I'm just thrilled to death because it's just the people are really concerned, and boy, we're on our way back. And don't let anybody kid you; those communists, they better hide for run for cover, because when the American people get riled up and everything, they're going to be an effective force, and that's coming, and it's coming very, very quickly.
I thank you for that, and I also really believe it, because it was, as you said a few weeks ago, we're all coming out of the woodwork. It's just coming out of the woodwork from everywhere, and these are things that our opposition didn't count on, I believe. I think they took this moment in time to try to, you know, push as much as they can. And it has backfired because it has achieved the opposite effect. It has united everyone against this administration. And I think, again, I agree, I think the lightning speed about consciousness rising is terrific. I went to the 9/12 march, and one of the things I was very impressed with was the quality of the signs, the signage. Was all about the Constitution. It was not about teabagging this or tea party that. It was all about the Constitution, and that is essential. And I think also that if you didn't wake up in 2009, you're probably not going to. But I think those who did will accelerate tremendously in 2010. I think this is the year. My New Year's post was, welcome to the evolution, because I think this is now. And I'm excited too. And yes, everyone wants to try to drown out the fire that is patriotism. But if you're an American and if you're a patriot, you can't. And that is what our opposition does not have. I guess they were never really Americans. So in that regard, in terms of getting to work, I would like to talk about Article 7 in our Articles of Freedom, which just happens to be about the Seventh Amendment, read. Isn't how perfect could that be? And for those of you, and the Seventh Amendment, I think, is one of those sleepers that nobody ever really talks about, but it's probably one of the most powerful amendments. And remember, even though people ridicule, hang on, let me back up a second. Red, when you were talking about intent, I really believe that too, and this is where I get frustrated, is because, and this is with all due respect to attorneys that I like and admire, but I do believe people don't allow you to talk about intent. The lawyers all stack it up with legal cases and reasons why you can't do that, and especially reasons why your average American citizen can't get it from reading basic history. Would you agree, or am I just overly sensitive to lawyers?
Well, I think that, for over 200 years, the legal profession, they have tried to more or less ignore or bury the Seventh Amendment. The Seventh Amendment, it puts justice within the reach of the common people,
yes,
at the grassroots, and that frightens the legal profession, because they want to be making a living off of our inability to defend ourselves or to prosecute a case for ourselves. They have a vested interest in making it so that the law is confusing for the rank and the file out here, so the Seventh Amendment that puts justice at the reach of everybody, and they don't like the idea of common law. Because common law is basically common sense. And, common sense is something that, it's supposed to come, you know, from our parents and our grandparents and such. It's supposed to be, learn the Ten Commandments. The Bible gives us the Ten Commandments, and I've challenged people. I say, now, if you were commissioned to write 10 statutes to create an orderly society, just sit down and write 10 of them. And I really believe that most people would sit down and they would write something that would be pretty well parallel to the Ten Commandments. You don't lie. You don't steal.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have things like this to have an orderly society, and of course that's what we want. But when you have a government that is oppressive, like what we've got right now, you don't have order. We don't have an orderly society in this country right now. And so that Seventh Amendment, of course, that's so close to my heart, because I've used it and used it very effectively, and it's there for everybody. It's something that is so exciting to think that we can go into a court and have a common law court where the party, the aggrieved party, the party that's looking for a remedy, can go in and explain his reasons for being there, and it just works so much better than if you've got lawyers that are on both sides of the thing. It's thrilling when you realize that the founders understood this. They understood what we needed, and they provided for it. And, of course, you're going to see a lot about this in the near future, because it's coming on strong.
Well, great. Well, just before we move on to the Seventh Amendment in detail, we did have a question that popped up in the chat room for you basically where you think the youth is on this whole issue of our Constitution and the dangers we face right now. And are they engaged? Do they care? Do they don't care? Are there pockets of youth that do?
I believe that the young people in this country, you know, they're not, they're on those, in the, their computers and their iPods and all this stuff. That's all my generation. We got left behind with all that.
Mm-hmm.
But there is so much information out there, and here we are. We've got these young people that are having a real difficult time finding a job. And they're being exposed to the real world out there, like they haven't been for at least a generation or more. And when that happens, when you've got them under stress, I joke about it. I say people that don't have a job and their job has gone overseas or something, that their hearing improves. The young people in this country, their hearing is pretty good right now. And, of course, this is what really thrilled me at the Continental Congress was the number of young people who were there, and they were very, very much involved. And I think you'll agree with me that some of those young people are going to be a force to be contended with out here. Now, did you hear my presentation there on the morning of the 18th?
Yes.
Well, you were there. I thought so.
Mm-hmm.
You remember what I said about when this thing, you know, as this federal government deteriorates, we're going to need leadership. And,
yes.
And I said that right in the beginning. And that I felt that the Continental Congress could be a very effective force. And see, at that time, I didn't know there was that many young people involved because I had just gotten in late the evening before. And this was at 8 o'clock in the morning. And so I had not seen or been exposed to the young people that were there. And so it was something that I said there. Going to see where there would be leadership come out of the Continental Congress. And the young people that I've been exposed to that were there, boy, I can see leadership. I mean, they've got it written all over their faces.
Well, I think that's marvelous. And just as an aside, and I also agree with you, when you called Jeff Williams the other night a youngster and he has gray hair, believe me, he and I have been exchanging issues of who's younger since you said that. And just kidding you. But anyway, I agree. I think there's also a point for, because I think the assault has been pretty effective, if you will, on all levels. Rather than kind of generational things right now with the youth, I think it really is like many generations, if you will. People within 4 or maybe 6 years apart, something like that, very different perspectives. Like, I want to know right now what's going on inside those colleges. And are the young people sort of forestalling this? On the other hand, I also have sort of adopted an approach to get at people who don't seem to be aware and young folks who are completely, you know, oblivious to what's going on. I tell them, do you realize that you have to pay for all of this? And that seems to, like, open their eyes pretty big. And especially when I ask many of them, have you ever seen a $100 bill? And they say, no. So can you imagine, you know, a block of $100 bills in terms of debt? Anyway, thank you for that perspective on the youth. There's a person who is working hard on a document. A couple of folks trying to work on a document that will that is sort of similar to the Federalist Papers, but it's not the Federalist Papers, but it's targeted for youth. It's targeted for people to sort of basically start with intent and explain where we are right now. So let me move back to the Seventh Amendment, because what I think you're saying is that as far as the founders' intent, one of the clear intents of the people can be found in Amendment 7. And let me read this, just because I happen to have my Constitution right here. And take it in, folks. In suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. No fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of common law. That is pretty powerful.
They don't teach it in law school. I've had lawyers tell me that the only thing that they teach in law school about the Seventh Amendment is that you are secured a right to a jury trial in a civil case. Now, over the last several years, I've had opportunities to talk to the lawyers and ask them about their understanding of the Seventh, and I've never found one that could quote it for me. I've never found one. Some of them will remember that it preserves the right to a jury trial in a civil case, but that's the only thing they remember about it. And of course, my contention is that the Seventh Amendment common law jury is the highest court in our land. And I say that because it says right there that the decision of that jury cannot be reexamined by any court in the land.
That's correct, that means the Supreme Court.
Yes, and of course I say that the Supreme Court is just 9 lawyers, and they're all government employees, which make them agents of the government. They are in the employ of the federal government, and so they have a vested interest if it's a controversy between a citizen and government. If a bureaucrat violates your First Amendment freedom of speech or your freedom of the press, there's 5 clauses in the First Amendment, and of course, if they violate your illegal searches and seizures of the Fourth Amendment, and of course the due process and all of the Fifth Amendment, if a bureaucrat violates any of those rights, where is your remedy? The remedy has to come in the Seventh Amendment, and I don't know if you have heard me say this before or not. I think I have said it on a program or two, but the 12 people on a common law jury, they come from the ranks of we the people, the sovereigns. And we're the ones who created the Constitution. We're the people. It was we the people who created that Constitution. And that's us, you and I. We the people. And we're the sovereign. And you know, you've heard a lot of this sovereignty talk or discussion on these shows. Well, it just so happens that the Seventh Amendment is the only place in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights where it more or less confirms the fact that we the people are the sovereigns. The Supreme Court, they are servants. They are not the sovereigns. At least on the job, they're not the sovereigns. And so we have the responsibility as sovereigns and as the creators of the Constitution and Bill of Rights, we have the responsibility to enforce them. And the Seventh Amendment, and of course the Sixth Amendment, That's criminal cases. You have the right to trial by jury. And, of course, in a criminal case, if the jury comes out and says not guilty, that case cannot be appealed. There is no appeal because those people on that jury are the sovereigns. We are the creators of the Constitution. And of course, if the criminal is convicted by that jury, that criminal has the right of appeal. But if the criminal or the so-called criminal is turned loose by the jury, there isn't a court in the United States of America that can overturn that jury verdict. And that really is, that makes, I mean, we ought to all be really excited about the power that is in our control if we have enough information and all and know how to use that power.
Excellent. That's right. And the Continental Congress captured exactly those sentiments. Here were the findings. The American people are the American sovereign. Number two, as a sovereign, the American people have the last say on the law. Number three, American citizens are called to sit on both grand and petit juries. And number four, in their capacity as jurors, the American people have the power, even the duty, to judge both the law and the facts. Now, what the Continental Congress also found is the judges don't tell you that, and neither do the attorneys. They don't tell you, as a juror, that you have that right. They ask you the question, they tell you, if the person did X, is found guilty of X, he has to be found guilty of X. He gives you instructions. And one of the primary cases where, again, the Seventh Amendment was upheld were the improper instructions that Samuel Chase gave to a jury, nearly got him impeached in the early 1800s for, again, misinstructing a jury. Now, before I get to the remedial instructions and so forth, there is this place where even patriots get caught up in the selection of the jury. Who chooses the random jury and so forth? Because as you've heard, Chalice, for example, is out, and there's an American Grand Jury Association and so forth. And like I say, even the patriots are saying, well, that's not right. It has to be chosen by a judge, or it has to be impaneled in some random way. Could you speak to that, Red, and let us know what you know about that system?
Well,
and that argument.
Yeah. You see, if we can get enough people informed, so that we've got at least one informed person on every petit jury or trial jury, that should be sufficient if we've got that person well enough informed. And that really isn't all that difficult. You know, in my years in this, I've seen a number of cases that were determined by one person on a jury being informed, and they take the time and using their patience and such, and they inform the other 11. On the trial jury. The grand jury is different because some grand juries are only 8 or 9 people. And, of course, a grand jury is a grand jury. It doesn't make any difference if it's a county grand jury, a state grand jury, a federal grand jury, or what. A grand jury, if it's made up of sovereign citizens, is a grand jury because they have the sovereignty, they have the say on the law, and more say than a judge, even the U.S. Supreme Court judges. The process is supposed to be, at this point, like with the federal. I'm talking about the federal here because every state is a little different. In California, they use driver's license, too. And I think there's some other states that use driver's license to call a jury. But the federal, for the most part, is they have all the names, all these names in these capsules, and they put them in a gadget, and they mix them up, and then they pick them out of that, and it's supposed to be a random selection. We've found, you know, a certain amount of tampering with that by the U.S. Attorney's Office. In trying to, get a jury, our grand jury, to suit their purposes. And, of course, that is something that a grand jury needs to investigate. We need some grand juries that will sit in on the process. When in the clerk of the court's office and such that they pick a jury, we need some people off of grand juries there just to observe how they're doing it. That grand jury has so much power, and they can be so effective. Just their presence in a process where they're selecting jurors would stop any, you know, mischief that might be going on, because nobody in government wants to become a target of an informed grand jury. The people in government, they know about the power of that grand jury. They understand it, and so it's been to their advantage to keep the people, in the dark as to what the grand jury is supposed to be. And of course, we're in the process of correcting that right now. And hopefully, there's people out there that are listening tonight that might have the opportunity to serve on a grand jury sometime. And they need to know how much power they have, how much they can do. As I gave seminars across the country, I used to say that the grand jury is the detergent in our political system. They're the ones, if you've got a dirty shirt, well, you put it in the washing machine with some detergent and clean it, wash it. And the grand jury, of course, if there's dirt, criminal activity in government, it's their responsibility to root it out, get it out, and see to it that the instigators of this, that they are brought to court and prosecuted for their misbehavior. And so this is one of the things, of course, that really got my attention at the Continental Congress. I heard so many people talking about grand juries, and that really pleased me immensely, I can assure you.
That's terrific. Now, I'm still myself studying on grand juries, and the Continental Congress came up with instructions. But let me ask you this again for our listening audience, but also for me too. Who gets to pose the grand jury question? Now, in another part of the Articles of Freedom, we have chastised the courts for refusing standing for individuals to challenge the constitutionality of anybody's activities, or a federal official or state official's activities. They're just rejecting these questions that come forward based on standing. But within the grand jury system that we have right now, and with who can bring those questions now on constitutionality, or do we have to rely on some public official who's maybe interested in this for his or her reasons? Can we ask a sheriff to impanel a grand jury?
The ideal, I think personally, is if you have a grand jury sitting at all times, and I think it should be, and they should be, there should be the transparency there so that people can know who they are, especially the grand jury foreman. In Texas, the state grand, well, it's the county grand juries, I should say, they're supposed to be, the grand jury foreman is supposed to be accessible. You're supposed to be able to go and talk to him. And you should be able, if you know who the people are sitting on the grand jury, you should be able to go to them and say, hey, let's go have a cup of coffee. I need to visit with you a bit. And mm-hmm. and just start an informal conversation. You don't need anything formal. It's just grassroots communications. And the ideal, as far as I'm concerned, is that the grand jury, you would know who they are, and you know, be brave enough and firm enough in your convictions to go and talk to them and saying, hey, I think there's something here that needs to be investigated, and more or less give the reasons for your thinking, and then the grand jury, you see that one person on the grand jury, at the next session when the grand jury meets, why, that person on the grand jury can bring it to the attention of the entire grand jury. Well, then they say, well, let's just invite this person in to visit with us, the entire body of the grand jury. Let's just see if they'll come in on an invitation. They don't need, if you want to have a complaint, if you have something that needs to be investigated, you shouldn't need a subpoena. Just an invitation to come in and meet with the grand jury would be sufficient. It needs to be, you know, as informal as possible. Because at the grassroots, we don't need a lot of paperwork. We don't need, you know, a lot of ritual and all of that. We the people, let's communicate with one another on an equal footing. And this is what's going to happen. I can see it happening. I can see it coming. This vote fraud. In Montana in 1988, I ran for governor, and the vote fraud that we had in the primary election was so rampant and so obvious. But in Montana, when they brought in a new constitution in the early 70s, they made it so that a grand jury could only be impaneled by a district judge. And so people, they spotted all this mischief and this criminal activity, and they went to district court judges and said, "Hey, we need a grand jury to investigate that." It was not possible. And when they put that in the new Montana Constitution in, I think it was 1973, I don't ever remember a grand jury ever being called in the state of Montana from that point on, either county or state, because the district judges are all attorneys. They don't want a grand jury in their area because almost all of them have got skeletons in their closet. They're in some kind of a racket. We had one district judge that was buying up all these homes in the probates that he was handling. He was buying up these homes where the families would like to sell the real estate and get the money and run. And at one time he had 37 homes built or bought in one county. And he bought them, you know, discounted prices. And he had a racket. Well, you see, he don't want a grand jury investigating him. And so the people finally got rid of him at an election. But you see, a grand jury is the proper mechanism for handling situations such as that. And, of course, the people in Montana were denied that. But now, this year, there's going to be an initiative on the ballot next November bringing back the grand juries to function properly in the state of Montana. And, of course, I'm all for it.
Now, that is interesting because as I was perusing through the Wyoming Constitution, not only do they leave it up to district judges, but the legislature can at any time establish or abolish a grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
So that should be subject to an initiative because that strikes me as, again, people trying to protect themselves. And the power goes all the way up there to... and I'll have to look at those stats on how many grand juries have been called in Wyoming. I don't think there have been that many since then.
Well, I'm sure, Dr. Kate, that in Wyoming you've got one federal grand jury for the entire state. That's what they've
mm-hmm.
been doing in Montana. And it's been, we found where there was one person that had served on three grand juries. Federal grand juries in the state, and the odds on this is just like zero,
right?
And the fact that this person had served once, when she was called the second time and the third time, she should have automatically been exempt. But one time in the late 70s. I went up and I discussed the problem we had with the U.S. attorney in the federal building in Billings, Montana. And in Montana, they were keeping the grand jury. The federal grand jury would meet once a month, minimum, and serve a year. But at the discretion of the U.S. attorney and the federal judges, they could hold them over an extra 6 months. And the U.S. attorney told me, he said, we have held the last grand jury over another 6 months because we're afraid that we might get a tax protester on the grand jury.
Whoa.
Yes.
Whoa. And
yeah.
In Wyoming, the current governor who has served two terms was the former U.S. attorney.
Mm-hmm. Bad combination.
Sort of like
yes.
How Michael Badnarik would say, it's obvious
yeah.
that something's going
yeah.
on. Very interesting. So as we continue our theme, just before we take off on just a few minutes of a break, but with this basis of the sovereign citizens, that we have the right to judge the law and the facts, we created remedial instructions to Congress, which were to... really work on the federal rules of civil procedure and the federal rules of criminal procedure to require judges to apprise all plaintiffs and defendants of their right under the Seventh Amendment to a common law grand jury. And then to amend both of these laws to require all judges in cases where the United States is a party to the case, to apprise jurors of the judge's conflict of interest. Don't you think that's going to go over really well? This is getting at the issue. This is getting back to constitutional governance. This is like no excuse for these judges, lawyers, so forth and so on. You get back to the Constitution. And then to amend federal rules of criminal procedure to provide for trials authorized only by indictments or presentments by independent, randomly impaneled citizens' common law grand juries, accessible to any individual having a complaint, and empowered to authorize any citizen of their choice to prosecute a case. to each of the states amending the rules governing civil and criminal cases to, again, apprise people of their rights under the Seventh Amendment, and to apprise the judges, to apprise the jury of the judge's conflict of interest. And I would say in cases where the legislature, like my state, has stepped in to rule that they can abolish anything, any grand jury, to move on those state rules, if by initiative, if in any other ways, way. And we'll stop there for a break, because the next piece is what we do, really, civic actions by the people, which allow us to give you more information on what people are doing and what we can do to inform everybody about being an informed citizen grand juror or citizen juror. So if you will, we're going to take about a 3-minute break and be right back. Hang on, Red.
I'll be here.
All right. Welcome back, everyone, to nearly the end of Revolution Radio. That was Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man. And I don't know, to me it sounded pretty wobbly. How did it sound to you, Red?
I don't know. I just like, I think it's trumpets, wasn't it?
And, yeah.
I I like a trumpet, of course. Mm-hmm. But, you know, music, I'm from the old school, I guess, and I like harmony. They don't use much harmony anymore. Mm-hmm. I come from the day when we really liked that four-part harmony.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear so little four-part harmony anymore. But Terry,
well, you know,
I'm going to
make it a point to look for that kind of music and load it here so you don't fall asleep during the break or go off. So
yeah, I met my wife in a small church in South Dakota when I was singing with a gospel quartet, and Terry, he was a part of a barbershop quartet thing. So Terry and I both, I guess, know what it is for harmony.
Wonderful, wonderful. No wonder you get along so well, and I would have to say that you both harmonize terrifically in the work that you do. So back to the civic actions. I have in front of me the Bill of Rights Jury Handbook. And again, what the Continental Congress finds and what Red has experienced his whole life is that, you know, it's rigged for essentially us not to be able to enforce the Constitution or any of our other rights through the Seventh Amendment. The next question is okay, now what do we do? And so here are three civic actions that I want to talk about, and also to get to the place where you can be true to being a fully informed grand juror and make it on the jury, and in fact not have a judge throw you out as a potential juror because he suspects that you are fully informed. The recommended civic actions by the people were, you know, when appointed to a jury, throw off the restraints of judicial tyranny by refusing to capitulate to any judicial instruction to judge only the facts. And this is what got Samuel Chase in big trouble. He basically said, look, I judge the facts. I judge the law. You can only look at that's it. He threw out grand jurors' opinions, unable to do that constitutionally, and like I say, nearly got impeached by that. So the second civic action is when appointed to a jury, demand to have all the issues of law argued in the presence of a jury and have the last say by judging the law. So this is what I understand is essentially the sidebars and the private conferences between the judges and the attorneys where issues of fact are discussed and so forth. The jury has the right to see that and should demand that. And as we've talked about, the most obvious case, the tax cases, income tax cases, where essentially the 16th Amendment was never ratified, and so that's unconstitutional. So any law based on that is also unconstitutional. No one is bound to follow that. You want to be a jury in a situation like that so you can basically say, again, I'm judging the law. The guy may have, you know, violated, done all these things that this law or statute said, but essentially it doesn't matter because it's an unconstitutional statute. That is your power to essentially, you know, enable people to not be penalized or extorted by the Internal Revenue Service. So the third civic action is to educate your family, friends, and community to learn about the Fully Informed Jury Association, and it's FIJA.com, and the power of judging the law as well as the accused, as well as the facts and so forth. So those three things, it's information. It's whatever you can. And like I say, I have a citizen's rule book here, the Bill of Rights Jury Handbook, And it essentially is a piece of the Constitution as well, but describes your rights and so forth. Now, remember, this has been a very interesting multi-year, multi-decade strategy to essentially separate us from the Constitution and from knowing what our rights are. So let's take the first civic action, Red. If you feel this way, if you understand a fully informed jury and you're in a process of jury selection, what do you say when the judge says, are you able to make a decision based on the law even if you don't agree with it?
Basically, you have to recognize when the judge makes his statement such as that, you recognize that he is wrong and that you have a responsibility to recognize that and recognize that he is, you know, he's trying to usurp power. And that usurpation is a powerful word that we just haven't used very much in our day-to-day language. But if he is outside of the law, if he is doing something that he doesn't have a right to do, you have every reason and good reason to say yes, you know, agree with him, and wait until you get into the deliberation room to make the corrections that need to be done. Mm-hmm. I remember a case. It was a tax case, and there was a retired military fellow. He was on the jury, federal jury panel, and he didn't know what kind of a case he was called to come in to serve for jury duty, and so he went to the federal courthouse at the appointed time, and he was there, and most of those panels are about 40 some odd jurors, potential jurors, and they pick the 12. Well, he told us, he said, I knew that I had the authority to go against what that judge was going to say. This was in federal court. And he said, I knew. And so he said, I was determined that they weren't going to be able to trip me up, that I was going to get on that jury when he went to the courthouse. And he got on that jury, and he held that jury for 3 days. It was a tax case, a critical tax case. He held that jury for 3 days. It took him that long to inform the other 11 on that jury of their responsibility to judge the law as well as the facts, and he was busy for 3 days. Mm-hmm. Explaining to the other 11 people what they should be doing, that they shouldn't be under the thumb of that federal judge. And after 3 days, they came out not guilty on all counts, and it was a major loss for the Internal Revenue Service. This is, it's kind of difficult for some people to say, well, I don't want to lie. But if somebody is holding you up and you've got a $100 bill in your shoe, you're not going to, you're going to give the guy the small change you got in your pocket and whatnot. You're not going to tell him about that $100 bill in your shoe. You're not going to do that. You're being mugged, and mm-hmm. so it's an outlaw that's taking your money. So if it's an outlaw that's taking your rights and abusing your rights and trying to use your power, you see, for his vested interests to benefit him, then you need to do whatever it takes to make sure you're still on that panel. And of course, we go to the scriptures, and of course we find the story of the children of Israel in Egypt. And when little Moses was born, there was a law. The Pharaoh had made a law that they were to destroy. They were to murder the male children of the house of Israel. Well, here this baby is born, and it's a little male. And so, what did they do? They made this little floating bassinet, I guess, and put it down in the reeds along the Nile River. And the king's daughter or somebody comes along, and they see that baby, and they take that baby, and they raise that baby. Now, they lied. Those people, they lied to preserve that life. Well, there's more to it, of course, and most people out there will understand the story. But anyway, if you have to tell a lie to that federal judge, you see, you have that responsibility. You protect your fellow American from that outlaw in that black dress. And that's an outlaw. So you see, Dr. Kate, I'm going to make a statement here. Every federal judge in the United States of America today is a felon. He's a criminal. And I can prove it because they have been covering up this fraud that we uncovered with that 16th Amendment evidence on the income tax amendment to the Constitution for the United States of America. Every federal judge in this country knows what we did. I'm the guy that started all that. I co-authored the book, The Law That Never Was. I started it. I was the first one to take it into federal court in Fort Worth, Texas in March of 1983. Here we are. We're in 2010. And these federal judges are outlaws, and they have kept us. In fact, I was talking this morning to one of the key attorneys in this battle to get this evidence before the U.S. Supreme Court, and they will not hear it. And all these district judges, all these appellate court judges, they all know about it. And they have done everything in the world to cover it up. It's obstruction of justice. I can name a half a dozen U.S. Titles of Title 18, statutes in Title 18, the U.S. Criminal Code. I can name you a half a dozen, and they're all guilty. And it's prima facie evidence. It's not
conjecture, for heaven's sake.
It's so clear and so positive. But they're still getting away with it. But when we get some grand juries going, that's going to end.
Absolutely. Also, I have to say that when you're in, I do believe we're in revolution right now. I do believe this is my own view. I do believe there was a coup in 2008 and 2009, and I do believe we're facing enemies of liberty. And in that regard, rather than pick up a gun at this point, I think the idea of being an informed juror is a good one. When you think about the tactics that have to be used basically to bring this government back, in a way that's a peaceful revolution, that we have a right to do so, I would say as well that this justifies it. And in fact, if a judge says, are you going to enforce the law even if you don't agree with it, I can answer yes to that, because there are lots of laws that are legitimate that I don't agree with that, I may have to say yes or no. But to get on a jury on a tax case, I could say the same thing. So I encourage people not to get, caught up on, you want to tell the truth, this kind of thing, but recognize that, in fact, the judge is lying to you. He's taking your rights by denying you an opportunity to know that. So he's a felon, he's a criminal. Yes, I would agree. And if the Supreme Court is refusing to hear this, that is unbelievable. That shows you how far this is. Now you understand why all these eligibility cases are being thrown out on standing. They don't think there's any right to be there. And the judicial tyranny that I see is, yes, excluding information that is critical to these cases. And there's your conflict of interest. How are these judges paid? Your tax dollars out of the illegal, unconstitutional 16th Amendment. Laws that are built up on that and extortion. You go to jail unless you pay. That's extortion. So this is the enemy we face. Now, on the issue, Red, of making sure that the law, issues of law, are argued in the presence of the jury, how and when do you do that and with whom?
The law, you see, especially in tax cases, because I'm more familiar with those.
Mm-hmm.
You see, if you try to get a judge or a prosecutor to tell you what section of the IRS code makes the individual liable for an income tax, they never have been able to produce a statute that makes the individual liable for the tax. It just isn't there. And I know a fellow down in Kansas. He's a third or fourth generation farmer on the place where he farms. And you know, it was just a very small amount of tax that could have been assessed because they'd had some bad years in one thing or another. But they charged him criminally under the income tax thing, and he was not a polished speaker. He was not a fellow that was used to getting up in front of an audience or and saying his piece. But when they took him into court for an arraignment, he asked the judge, he said, I need to know what statute I'm charged with violating. And the judge, he goes into a tirade and whatnot, and he says, everybody knows that you're required to file an income tax return if you have an income. Now, that was his response. He said, everybody knows.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't come up with a statute, did he? He had no intention of coming up with a statute because he knows it isn't there. Now, this reminds me, when he said that, this is what Samuel Chase told the U.S. Senate when he was on trial in that impeachment trial back there in 1800. He said, everybody knows that the jury has the right to judge the law as well as the facts in a controversy. That was his exact words. That case, the record on that case is just fabulous. And it's two volumes. The U.S. Senate did a tremendous job. It was a tremendous trial before the U.S. Senate. Everybody knows. You see, at that point in time, everybody knew the power of the jury. That's the difference between then and now. That farmer friend down there in Kansas, he went to jail for a year because that judge manipulated the evidence, wouldn't let him use the Constitution in his defense. The judge just stripped him of any kind of a defense. And he went to jail, federal prison, for a year. And, this is worth fighting for.
It's totally criminal.
Yes, totally criminal.
Right.
The worst kind of criminal is always been somebody that is violating laws in the name of government.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
That is, I mean, the guy that takes a gun and goes into a bank and robs the bank isn't near. He's not near the criminal in my sight as that judge that is stealing people's rights, stealing their lives. They stole a year out of that man's life and his family. That judge stole him from his family.
And right now, the woman who was in Aaron Russo's film From Freedom to Fascism, Sherry Peel Jackson, is serving a four-year jail time term right now.
Right.
She tried to answer a contest. A person mm-hmm. put up $50,000. She was a former IRS person. Put up $50,000 to find the law. She said, "Surely I can do this." Mm-hmm. She couldn't find it. She wasn't accused of not paying income taxes. That didn't happen. She was accused of bringing it up, and now she's in a four-year jail term. This is absolutely criminal. And when you think about this, right after the Seventh Amendment came up, or right after Article 7 on the Seventh Amendment, we have our income tax and the 16th Amendment. Excuse me, let me kill that phone there, excuse me, where we basically, advise people of this, and you can see how important a grand jury is, because even if that individual, like in the case of the person in Kansas, is not able to, get that before the judge and the judge manipulate it, you as a juror can ask the judge mm-hmm. for the statute that this person is accused of violating. And as a juror, if they can't provide it, which they can't provide, what are you to conclude? It's a matter of getting that, of being informed about your rights, whether you are the accused or whether you are on a jury, but also knowing truly what the background is here so you can help your fellow citizens move forward.
I have met Sherry Jackson. And she is one of the nicest people that you will ever meet. Mm-hmm. She is just one really decent human being. And she impresses everybody that way. She is just that kind of a person. And here she is, a victim of a criminal in a black dress, calling himself Your Honor.
Yes. And, again, the Continental Congress, would you want to walk back to the Constitution and constitutional governance? I mean, you think about paying back the money that was taken and releasing immediately every political prisoner that's in jail over this right now, and, in fact, impeaching every single judge in this country who knows about this, forbidding them forever to hold any office of pleasure under the United States government, and getting some people in there who are constitutional people. And this is simple, because it's just now, well, it's not simple, of course. You can see how pervasive it is. It's so pervasive, it's obvious, it's dripping with contempt and fraud. And with Sherry Peel Jackson, I just want everyone to know she has a website, and her family has not heard from her since January 1st. The Continental Congress members have been trying to interview her because of the additional attention. Apparently, she's being given the quote-unquote diesel treatment, where she's ridden around on a prison bus to several different prisons. And we can't find her, and of course this is outrageous. So we encourage anyone out there who's listening to get on her website, Sherry Peel, P-E-E-L, Jackson.com, and send a letter of support. Let her know we're thinking about her, and it's important. This is the way they treat her. And like, remember this, she didn't even not pay her income taxes. This is simply a matter of telling the truth. Arrested, jailed. She has beautiful. criminal.
And she's got severe health problems.
And severe health problems, which we worry that she's not being taken care of as well. And if you're riding around on a bus all day with no treatment, this is Graves' disease. There's some serious issues involved with this. But this is the example of where we are right now. And what is happening is a lot of people are realizing that, oh, my goodness, all my taxes are going to go up. And then they figure out, and then they hear that the 16th Amendment doesn't work. And then they hear also that they have these powers as jurors, because who convicted Sherry Peel Jackson but an uninformed jury?
Yes.
An uninformed jury.
The judge manipulated the jury. And
yep.
It just makes my blood boil.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've seen this so many times, and when they make a victim out of somebody like Sherry, that is such a nice person, a tremendous personality, and she's just an outstanding person, and that's why they had to get her out of circulation, because she is so honest and so. Just a beautiful person, and she's a black woman, and she is a CPA. She's an educated woman, and just a person that you're proud to know them. You don't mind being associated with people like that. Let me tell you a story. This is just kind of a funny story in a way, but back in 1981, I think it was, we had run a TV special across Montana, and we had an old buffalo rancher. This old timer, he was up in years. He had to be close to 70. And he refused to file a state income tax. And, of course, the state income tax is always tied to the federal. So when the federal goes, all your state taxes go too, state income taxes. Anyway, they prosecuted Jack in the state court, and the state judge, he wouldn't let old Jack put on a defense or anything, and he sentenced Jack to 4 years in the state penitentiary. Well, the appeals court, of course, the state Supreme Court, they upheld the conviction, and you had to anticipate that, of course. Anyway, we ran this television special, and in Missoula, Montana, I was there, and we had a meeting there the next evening after the television special, and we had quite a tremendous crowd, and... to start my presentation, I said, "You all know our friend over there in Deer Lodge in the state penitentiary, Jack, the buffalo farmer rancher." And everybody knew the story because the press had just made a big deal out of that to try to, psychologically intimidate the people of the state of Montana that you don't oppose the state income tax or you're going to go to jail. Anyway, I said, "Now, we all in this state, we all know that Jack is sitting over there in prison, and he'd been in there for over 400 days when this happened." And I said, "We owe Jack something. We the people. We need to get a grand jury, an informed grand jury, and we need to investigate this case, and... we need to see to it that judge has to serve at least one day for every day that Jack spends in the jail." Well, that was in Missoula. We went to Butte, Montana the next night, and we had a meeting there, and I did the same thing. And people would always respond, and so we ended up in Helena, Montana, the state capital where Jack had been prosecuted and where this judge was located. And I did the same thing again, and that was on a Friday, I think, if I remember right. On the following Sunday morning, Jack was in his cell, and a couple of guards came, opened the door, and said, Jack, they had a couple of cardboard boxes, I think, and they said, put your stuff in the box. You're going out. You're getting out of here.
Whoa.
There was no paperwork, and to this day there's never been any paperwork. And they put him out on the street. He didn't have a dime in his pocket, of course. But he did know some people in Deer Lodge, Montana, so he walked to their place and called home. His daughter was taking care of things at home, and she came over and got him. To this day, there's never been any kind of a paperwork, explain why he was released, because he had over 2 years yet on his sentence. And releasing him on a Sunday morning the way they did, he just put his little things he had, why, put him in a cardboard box or two and put him out the front door, and he's gone. And so, at some point we may have to start doing this and saying that when we get some grand juries that are functioning, if we put out the word that these judges might just have to spend some time in jail to compensate a little bit, and, of course, losing their pensions would be a step in the right direction, too, going to their victims and that type of thing. But, they get that. They can get a message, and we need to send them a message. And when I say that federal judges, every single federal judge in this country is a felon, and it is easy to prove. There's no problem proving it whatever. The U.S. Supreme Court, they say, well, the courts haven't ruled that the 16th Amendment is a fraud. Well, it just so happens that the courts are inferior to the sovereigns.
That's right. They don't have a right to review it.
They are not the ones to say whether it's constitutional or not. We need to get this to a grand jury that will look at this evidence. And of course, there is a case right now, and I don't remember the name on it because I just found out about it here in the last few days, that there's a hearing on a writ of certiorari at the U.S. Supreme Court that's coming up the 15th of this month. And from what I am told, the evidence on the 16th Amendment fraud is there before the U.S. Supreme Court right now. So I sent some information today, and I'm talking to an attorney about it. They're going to try to put something in there, and noticing the federal judges there on the Supreme Court of their conflict of interest.
Wow, this is huge.
Yeah. Wow.
This is huge.
Yes.
This is
it
huge.
It should be. I'll tell you, it's going to be huge even if they rule against it. Because if they rule against it, and I'm saying this hoping that they're listening in, they've got their big ears listening in. If they rule against it, we've got some more evidence sending 9 corkscrew lawyers to jail.
That's right. And, Red, we're out of time, but I'd love to pick this up either tomorrow or next week if you're available. But I wanted to ask you, so really, they are not teaching law students at all about this either.
They aren't, and
they're just covering the whole thing up.
Yes, and it's on purpose that they're doing that, and
yep.
It's a plan. It's well planned and orchestrated, choreographed. it's all there, You see, there isn't a federal judge in this country that doesn't have skeletons in their closet, because if a lawyer is squeaky clean, he is not going to be appointed to a federal judgeship because they have to have these skeletons in their closet that they can use to, you might
keep
say,
themselves
keep
themselves in power.
Yes.
Wow. Wow. This was terrific, Red. I want to thank you so much for joining us this evening, and I hope a lot of folks will listen to the podcast. I want to thank all of our listeners and the few people in the chat room. We always tend to listen. Red, thank you very, very much, and we will talk with you very soon. Thank you
very
for
good.
Everything.
Yeah, I'll
okay.
be available.
Very good. Thank you. Good night.
Yeah. Good night.
Find the cost of freedom.